This is an ABC podcast.
Good morning around Australia. Welcome to AM. I'm Sabra Lane. On today's program, bushfire emergency terrified residents in two states flee as dozens of homes and other buildings go up in flames.
It was really bad. Like, I thought I was going to die. I messaged my mum saying I love you and all that.
Measles, antibiotics and lung disease. I'll discuss these issues with Australia's Chief Medical Officer Brendan Murphy and frustrated commuters in Melbourne's outer suburbs left stranded with no public transport.
We feel sort of cheated, you know. Now people have realised that there is no train station here. It's not going to be a train station here.
But first this morning, Turkey's wasted no time following the sudden decision by the US president to withdraw troops from Syria. Convoys of tanks have been moved to the border and it's launched overnight strikes against Syria's Kurds, it says, to stop reinforcements and supplies ahead of its looming invasion of Kurdish-controlled Syria. Our Middle East correspondent Adam Harvey filed this report from Beirut.
Just 48 hours after Turkey got the thumbs up from US President Donald Trump, it says it's ready to cross the border into Syria. Turkey says it has already carried out strikes on the Iraq-Syria border to prevent military reinforcements coming to the Syrian Kurds, and it's moved more artillery and tanks to the border. On the streets of Qamishli, there's a sense of dread about what's to come. The US has two faces, and surely attackers will destroy the area as they destroyed Afrin and other places. We saw how residents got displaced and their homes were stolen. We call on the United Nations. We as Kurds love peace, coexistence and love. We hope that this attack that will target the area will be stopped. The area does not need war, and we do not call for war. We call for peace. Turkey does not see the SDF as peace-loving. Academic Ömer Özkılıç with the SETA think tank in Ankara explains why Turkey is so hostile towards the left-wing political party, the PKK, and its Kurdish militias.
There's a real potential danger, and this is what the PKK is going after. They, in the long term, want to divide Turkey, and this is a national security threat or risk to the Turkish territorial integrity.
In the late-night statement that started all this, Donald Trump said Turkey will take over responsibility for the 12,000 IS fighters detained in Syria. It's difficult to see how Turkey will do this. The SDF isn't about to hand over one set of enemies to another, and it's unlikely their prisons will be captured during a conflict. They're well outside Turkey's planned invasion zone. The Lowy Institute's Roger Shanahan says it could represent wishful thinking from Mr. Trump rather than any prisoner deal with Turkey.
You would have to say it's one of the last things that they'd want. The majority of the prisoners are Iraqi, and the Iraqi government is still trying to come to terms with how they're going to take them off the hands of the Kurds. So the last thing the Turks want are thousands of Iraqi prisoners, and then there are all the other fighters, you know, the Western fighters whose governments, including Australia, are working slow time to try and get these detainees back.
Buses carrying Turkish special forces were filmed driving towards the border near the Syrian town of Manbij at the western end of Turkey's planned safe zone. The city was once held by IS and was won back in 2016 by Kurdish troops backed by American special forces. Now the Americans have gone from Manbij, and the city could be the scene of the first shots of another conflict, one between Turkey and the Kurds. This is Adam Harvey in Beirut for AM.
After a traumatic day for communities battling bushfires in New South Wales and Queensland yesterday, authorities say conditions have improved, but that the danger hasn't passed. Strong winds and high temperatures fueled the flames, destroying homes and forcing residents to flee their homes. David Sparks reports.
There was very little that residents in the northern New South Wales town of Rapville near Casino could do but flee as fire engulfed their homes.
We were inside and the flames were coming underneath the door, and it was crazy. It was intense. It was really bad. Like, I thought I was going to die. I messaged my mum saying I love you and all that.
Still in shock, they arrived at the evacuation centre, still covered in soot.
I got nothing. Worked hard for a lot of my stuff and now it's all gone. I've only got What's on me and me dog?
It's believed up to 30 homes and buildings may have been destroyed or damaged across northern New South Wales. The mayor of Tenterfield, Peter Petty, says it's not the first time the town has been under threat this fire season.
Well, our poor old town of Tenterfield should be pretty well right now. We've had burning on the south and the north and the west. But anyway, just can't believe that it just keeps happening.
He says he's never seen conditions like this before.
We're facing a drought that we've never seen before. And it's not only Tenterfield, it's right across the tablelands. No one's ever seen the condition of this country, you know, in the state it's in at the moment.
Nearly 700 firefighters have been fighting blazes across northern New South Wales. New South Wales Rural Fire Service Superintendent Michael Brett is one of them.
Some of the areas were just too dangerous for crews to get into. And, you know, until that fire situation starts to abate, it's just still too dangerous in some areas to go in.
Temperatures have dropped this morning and winds have eased, but the fires still cover thousands of hectares and will take a lot of work to put out.
First thing this morning is we'll have an aircraft go up and start doing some recon around the area and just see where there's fire that's still of major concern that we'll put our attentions with the aircraft we have there on the ground in Casino.
The New South Wales Rural Fire Service Deputy Commissioner is Rob Rogers.
We've got a lot of firefighters and we're going to be working very hard to try and get containment on these fires. We've got a few days of milder conditions and obviously firefighters will use that. But it is fair to say these firefighters have been at it for weeks and weeks and they are getting tired.
North of the border, crews in southeast Queensland have also been fighting several fires. More than 100 people were forced to spend last night in an evacuation centre in Laidley, west of Brisbane, where one home was destroyed. Lockyer Valley Mayor Tanya Milligan says the Laidley fire was unexpected.
There's been something like 10,000 hectares that have been burnt. And bear in mind the fire that was out at Glenrock, that commenced around 19th of September and had been managed by the fireys. And then, you know, what happened in Laidley was just unexpected. The disaster coordinator and I were coming back from the fire that was out at the Glenrock Mount Sylvia area. And then I was actually called to say, you do know there's a fire at Napier Street in Laidley.
It's Lockyer Valley Mayor Tanya Milligan ending that report from David Sparks and Julia Holman. On AM yesterday, you might have heard about the recommendation to ban repeats of some common antibiotic medicines because of concerns about misuse and the spread of superbugs. This morning, we're hearing from Professor Brendan Murphy about why. He's Australia's Chief Medical Officer and Principal Medical Advisor to the Federal Health Minister, Greg Hunt. Professor Murphy, thanks for joining AM. How serious is the problem of antibiotic resistance and how soon could the ban on repeat prescriptions be introduced?
So antimicrobial resistance is a serious problem around the world and also in Australia, and we do face the risk of increasingly unavailable antibiotics in the future, such that we might even see infections that are impossible to treat. This potential ban on repeat prescriptions is part of our strategy to deal with this problem, and it's directly addressing the overuse of antibiotics where they're being used, where they're not necessary. And so the proposed changes is to stop a routine repeat being provided on common antibiotics so that people only use repeat prescriptions when their GP specifically wants them to have them.
And that ban, could that just be weeks or months away?
It could be. The Minister has to make a decision on the recommendation of the PBAC, but the Minister's indicated he's supportive of these changes.
A report earlier this year to the government warned that there will come a time when routine surgery in Australia becomes much higher risk and that things like urinary tract infections become much more difficult to treat. How far off is that scenario in Australia?
Well, we are already seeing instances where we've had intensive care units, operating theatres and some wards that have had to have significant interruptions to their procedures due to outbreaks or detection of resistant organisms. We get on top of these things pretty quickly in Australia, but there have been instances overseas where, for example, a whole transplant program has been stopped for months because of the presence of resistant organisms. So these threats are real and potentially on our doorstep.
What about the race to find new antibiotics? Is enough attention and money being spent on that?
Yes, I think one of the challenges is that there is not a pharmaceutical company incentive, really, because antibiotics aren't things that are used for a long time. They're used for a short course, and pharma don't find it commercially attractive to invest in this space. So governments increasingly, and philanthropy is now putting a lot of effort into this space. The World Health Organization is doing that, and the Australian government is doing that. So we're having doing a lot of work in that space to try and repurpose old antibiotics and put some effort into developing new ones. But we still have to look after the ones we have as the highest priority.
I wonder if I could ask you about the sharp jump in measles cases being reported in Perth, and there have been some on the Gold Coast too. How much of a concern is it to you that there's this re-emergence of a disease that we once thought was conquered?
Well, I think it's a serious concern. It's obviously a bigger concern in some other countries in the world, like New Zealand, where there's been, you know, over 1,000 cases. And it is a very clear, I see it as a canary in the coal mine, showing what happens if our vaccination rates aren't kept up. Measles is a hugely contagious disease. If you're not immune, you will get it if you come into contact with someone. And it's quite a nasty disease. 1 in 1,000 children who get it will die, and, you know, another 1 in 200 will get serious long-term complications. It's a nasty disease, and it's simply related to poor immunity in a small proportion of the people. Our immunity in the community is quite high, so we don't have what we call endemic transmission of measles occurring from person to person for a long period of time. But what we're seeing is people, some small number of people with reduced immunity, generally who've gone overseas to a high prevalence country and brought measles back and spread it to a small number of people in their local community who have poor immunisation. So the message is that everyone must be fully immunised and everybody needs to have had two doses of the MMR vaccine, unless they were born before 1966, when you've almost certainly had measles itself. And we know that there are some people, particularly people born between 1966 and the early 90s, who only had one dose. And everybody who's travelling, we recommend that they strongly have another dose if they're not absolutely confident that they've had two doses.
All right. Who's to blame for the resurgence? Is the anti-vax movement, should it shoulder some of the blame here?
I think it should, because the anti-vaxxer movement has been peddling blatant lies about the measles vaccine. Particularly, there was some fraudulent research some years ago suggesting that it was related to autism. It was completely debunked. But that's been one of the messages that some in the anti-vaxxer movement have been putting out there, and that's led to some vaccine hesitancy in some parents. And we do know that a significant number of the measles cases in Australia have actually been people under 20 who have just not had their full vaccinations.
There's been a big jump in lung disease, thought mostly due to the cutting of artificial stone. When we last spoke, a task force had been just set up and you were on it. Do you have a better idea now of how many cases there are around Australia?
We still don't absolutely know, but we do know that it's some hundreds. It's over 250 cases that we're seeing, which is an absolute tragedy. Some of the states haven't completed fully screening every worker who might be exposed, but one of the task force tasks is to make sure that every person who's been involved in this industry is comprehensively screened to make sure that those with early disease are detected.
Yeah, some workers want artificial stone banned. How likely is that?
At the moment, that's something that's certainly a potential consideration. There's no doubt that this material can be safe if it's handled safely, and the industry is doing a lot of work in self-regulation, making sure they don't even supply it to people who don't have a safe environment. But that's something that government could consider in the future. But at the moment, the highest priority is to make sure that every workplace where it is used is made completely safe with the right protective equipment, and to make sure that we screen every worker who's been involved in this industry to make sure that we detect every case, even those early detectable cases.
Professor Murphy, thank you very much for joining AM this morning.
Pleasure.
That's Australia's Chief Medical Officer, Professor Brendan Murphy. When you do go to the doctor, most of us expect to spend a bit of time in the waiting room. But in some country towns, a lengthy wait begins before patients even make it to the practice, with locals struggling to get appointments due to GP shortages. It's prompting some rural doctors to call for less red tape and new initiatives to encourage medical students to move to the country. Claudia Long reports.
For residents of St George in southwest Queensland, it's been a tough time to get a doctor's appointment. Our patient base in St George is 2,500 people. In the past, we've had waiting times of up to 3 weeks.
That's made it a difficult few years for the managing director of the local medical centre, Alex Benn.
Right now, we've got enough GPs, but that's the first time in the last 5 years.
And the community has been feeling the squeeze.
Puts more pressure on the GPs as well, who, you know, they get it down the street. You're walking through the shop and say, oh, I can't get an appointment. And it puts more strain on the hospital and health services.
St George is far from the only town facing doctor shortages, according to the Rural Doctors Association of Australia. At times, there are hundreds of vacancies listed by state workplace agencies.
There's certainly a massive need for more healthcare workers in the bush, and it's an ongoing push to ensure that rural communities have the health workforce.
Dr. John Hall is the association's president-elect, and he says red tape is keeping doctors out of country areas.
There is a significant burden of paperwork when it comes to credentialing. There is no national standard for this.
But that isn't the only part of the problem that needs to be solved.
There is a myth that you need to be in a big city hospital to train appropriately.
Hi, my name's Sam Newbury. I'm a final year medical student with the Flinders Northern Territory Medical Program.
Sam Newbury's done a few remote placements in towns like Alice Springs as part of his medical degree. While he's enjoyed them, he doesn't want to make it a permanent move.
I would definitely be interested in doing some rotations there as part of my training, but I don't think I'd be interested in being based there. The things I value in life, like my friends, family, the kind of activities I like doing, are mostly sort of city-based things.
And Sam Newbury is far from alone.
About a third, just over a third of students indicate that they want to practice outside of one of the major capital cities.
That's Professor Ian Simons, Dean of Medicine at the University of Adelaide and President of Medical Deans for Australia and New Zealand. The group commissions a survey of all final year medical students, asking what they intend to do with the rest of their career. And he says there are a number of reasons stopping students like Sam from making the move to a rural area.
Often students who might have been inclined to go and practice rurally will have done a number of years of training in a major city, perhaps settled down in that area.
At practices like St George Medical Centre, Managing Director Alex Benn says keeping in touch after students complete placements is key to improving staff numbers.
And it really comes back to the practice staying in communication with those med students for the next 3 or 4 years until they graduate.
And that's an approach backed by Professor Ian Simons.
The key here really is providing high quality experience for students so they can see what it would be like to work in a rural area and they get to be inspired.
Professor Ian Simons from the Medical Deans for Australia and New Zealand, ending Claudia Long's report. Australia's Navy chief says it's possible the country's future submarine fleet could eventually switch to nuclear power. Vice Admiral Mike Noonan has opened an international maritime conference in Sydney where he says defence is keeping a close eye on emerging technologies. Here's defence correspondent Andrew Green.
On Sydney's Darling Harbour, naval chiefs and defence industry leaders from across the globe have gathered for talks on strategy, the region and military hardware. The Pacific Maritime Conference is now in its 20th year, and this time it's being hosted by a Navy chief who's been in the job for just over a year.
We've got more people, more stands, more international delegations at this year's conference than we've ever seen before.
Vice Admiral Michael Noonan says he and his colleagues are keeping a close eye on emerging defence technologies as Australia embarks on a $90 billion naval shipbuilding program. The biggest component of that plan is the $50 billion future submarine project.
At this point in time, I believe that they will be 12 conventional submarines. But as I've said in past announcements, the ability that we have with continuous shipbuilding is to innovate as we go. And I am absolutely of the mind that the 12th submarine will be different to the first.
But could the French-designed diesel-electric fleet eventually switch to nuclear propulsion?
A change in the propulsion system for the attack-class submarines is something that will no doubt be discussed over the next 30 years, bearing in mind that by the time we deliver number 12, it will be 2055. I'll be 99 years of age. So come back and ask me that question then.
AM understands Naval Group, the French company chosen to build Australia's next submarines, has briefed Defence that switching to a nuclear boat would involve a completely new design. In any case, the federal government isn't keen to canvass the option publicly. The new Defence Industry Minister, Melissa Price, is attending her first Pacific Maritime Conference.
As people in the UK and America have said to us, there is just no time like now to be involved in defence industry in Australia, so it's very exciting.
And just more broadly on submarines, could you ever see a day where we go the nuclear option?
No, that's not an option for our Australian government.
The Defence Industry Minister, Melissa Price, ending that report from Andrew Green. The domestic defence sector and many other industries are grappling with the threat of looming skill shortages. In New South Wales, the government's even encouraging industry groups to help design courses in the hope that they might lure students into much-needed fields. Georgia Hitch reports.
With more than 100,000 employees and hundreds of millions of dollars in global contracts, Lockheed Martin is one of the biggest defence companies in the world. But it's struggling to find the right workers in Australia.
That skill force is there, but not in a lot of depth.
Joe North is the chief executive of Lockheed Martin Australia. From boilermakers to engineers, he says there are skills shortages in almost every part of the defence industry. It puts companies like Lockheed Martin in a race for qualified staff.
It's just more competitive. So I've watched the Googles of the world go in and hire the entire software class at the university in their second year of uni. So that makes it a little more difficult to go find those resources locally.
To change that, Lockheed Martin has been teaming up with regional TAFE colleges to collaborate on courses that might give the company the skilled workforce it needs. That even includes designing the curriculum and providing students with on-the-job experience.
So we're working with TAFE, the Hunter region, and we're working with Uni Newcastle as an example for the F-35 in those two areas you picked up, cyber and ICT. And we're looking at how we get the schools to be able to bring those capabilities and skills to classrooms.
It's a model the New South Wales Skills Minister, Jeff Lee, would like to see other companies follow.
I certainly think that we need to focus, and TAFE or the other skills providers, the other RTOs, need to focus on training for jobs, not for training for training's sake. I think the integral link between and collaboration between industry is essential. Industry need to play their part in terms of the design, the delivery and the assessment so that we make sure we're 100% aligned with industry requirements.
But to entice students to even consider traineeships or apprenticeships, attitudes need to change.
We need a cultural shift to say that a vet career can be an equal alternate pathway to a great job and rewarding career.
And with New South Wales keen to grab a piece of the federal government's $90 billion naval shipbuilding plan, the minister is acutely aware of the need to tackle the skills gap.
We've just got to make sure that we move quickly to take every opportunity to make sure that we seize those opportunities. We need to get the demand from the students to choose vet as a viable career.
Lockheed Martin's Joe North hopes the lure of a possible job and word of mouth will provide the incentive needed.
Where we're recruiting the students to come in after their second year of school, they spend time with us and work for 6 months, then they go back and finish their curriculum. We pay them while they're there, and then we've been able to start getting that interest up and capture, and then they go back and talk to friends, and the next thing you know, it starts spreading again.
That's Lockheed Martin Australia Chief Executive Joe North ending Georgia Hitch's report. Cybersecurity experts are calling on the federal government to up its game when it comes to protecting your data. While cyber breaches cost businesses $29 billion a year, several of the government's own departments don't comply with minimum security standards, which may be leading to more attacks. Isabel Rowe reports.
Australia's best cybersecurity minds are gathered in Melbourne, many with warnings that we're not doing enough to protect data. Among them is Professor David Watts.
Why are we pursuing policies which see much more of our information being shared when the security risk associated with that has not been properly dealt with?
The former Victorian Privacy Commissioner, now La Trobe University information law expert, argues that's contributing to an exponential increase in cyber attacks. The federal budget for cyber threat mitigation is about $4 billion this financial year. Add that to the more than $20 billion estimated annual cost to the economy of successful cyber attacks, and Professor Watts says Australia Australians aren't getting value for money.
There is no other area of policy where such a, you know, enormous costs are borne by the economy and where we seem to be less safe than more safe.
While businesses are the most common targets, government agencies are increasingly being hacked. David Watts is calling on governments to wind back their widespread sharing of information between departments.
We have governments increasingly want to share information under open data policies, and all of those initiatives involve our personal information being circulated more broadly.
Cybersecurity policy is the responsibility of the Home Affairs Minister, Peter Dutton, who wasn't available for an interview. In a statement, a spokesperson for the Home Affairs Department says the government has committed $156 million to a cyber resilience and workforce package and will develop a 2020 cybersecurity strategy. But opposition spokesman on cybersecurity, Tim Watts, claims the government is already behind.
Commitments made under the 2016 cybersecurity strategy have never been followed through on. It was a commitment to develop an information sharing portal to share threat intelligence gathered by the government with business. That's never happened.
And not all government departments have yet met the minimum recommended security standards devised by the Australian Signals Directorate. Rachel Falk is the chief executive of the Cybersecurity Cooperative Research Centre. She says the government is working to meet those standards.
You have government focused on that, and that they can really answer questions about how data will be secure. How is it being looked after? So people, there's trust with government about that, and they trust the systems and services government deliver.
That's the chief executive of the Cybersecurity Cooperative Research Centre, Rachel Falk, ending Isabel Rowe's report. If you're behind the wheel or sitting in a bus or a train this morning, how happy are you with the amount of time you're commuting to and from work? According to the ABC's Australia Talks national survey, many of us aren't. And that's particularly true for residents in Melbourne's outer west. The area includes the rapidly expanding suburb of Tarneit, where families who moved in just months ago on the promise of good transport links to the city say they're feeling tricked and trapped. Ben Knight reports.
It's not until you actually step off the afternoon rush hour train to Tarneit that you get a sense of how tough this commute is. At 5 o'clock in the afternoon, commuters here don't walk to their cars, they run, and they do it to avoid getting stuck in the traffic jam getting out of the car park.
They're really racing to get out, aren't they?
Oh, yeah, true. This is actually an accident bound to happen. A pedestrian will get hit.
Arnav Sati's lived here for 3 years and he sees this every day.
Give it 5 minutes. By the time I'll walk to my car, this whole thing would be full.
Tarneit Station only opened in 2015 and almost immediately became the second busiest V-Line station in Victoria. Every morning by 7 o'clock, the car park is overflowing, and that leaves latecomers, like people who have to drop their kids at daycare, to find a park where they can, illegally. So they're risking council fines or even being blocked in by other cars. This is the coalface of Australia's booming population growth, where new housing estates roll out on the edge of major cities, way ahead of the transport links promised by the developers. Namrata Bahadur and her husband Binod moved out here to Tarneit just 4 months ago, and they feel they were lied to.
They used to pinpoint that place where the proposed train station was supposed to be. Now in the emails that they send, the flyers, there is nothing like that.
But what hasn't disappeared are the bus stops that have been marked out on the streets in these neighbourhoods. The problem is there are no buses. No one knows when or if they'll ever come. So people who live here face a long walk to the nearest bus stop, to catch the bus to the nearest station, to then take the long ride into the city. Some commutes can be up to 2 hours each way.
Now people have realised that there is no train station here, so that has brought down the value for the property.
The results of the ABC's Australia Talk survey show that people here are more likely than anywhere else in Australia to say they'd be happier if they spent less time commuting. But it's a close-run thing because it's a very similar story in other growth areas right around Australia's big cities. The outer suburbs are booming, but the jobs aren't moving with them, so new residents suffer massive commutes no matter how they choose to get to work. Even getting around their own neighbourhoods isn't easy, which is why what really worries people like Arnav Sati is what the future holds.
It's actually becoming like a modern slum, if I may call it. It can actually go into social isolation in 10 years' time if it's neglected like the way it is right now.
This is Ben Knight in Tarnit, reporting for AM.
And if you're curious about where you fit in compared with other Australians, you can head to abc.net.au/AustraliaTalks. That's AM for today. Thanks for your company. I'm Sabra Lane.
Hi, I'm Stephen Stockwell.
And I'm Angela Wypierre, and we're from the ABC's Daily News and Current Affairs podcast, The Signal.
Donald Trump has been itching to get US troops out of Syria for a very long time, and now he is getting his way. That means the US is walking away from the Kurds, a group that was right on the front lines defeating ISIS.
The Kurds are often talked about as the good guys in this region, and without US support, they're staring down a Turkish invasion. But is it really that simple? And could the US be about to score a massive own goal here?
That's The Signal, every weekday morning on the ABC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.